This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with two powerful interviews for you. First, Dr. Robert Kopp explains why humans die in heat waves and why that will get worse as climate change develops. Then the incredible Dr. Jeremy Leggett returns, talking about his open-source book, Winning the Carbon War, his booming solar business in the UK, and a project to light up Africa with solar lanterns. All that plus climate music. Let's get going.
Radio EcoShock.
Are we making a world where it will be too hot to go outside? Is the latest deadly heat wave in India a sign of that? We'll talk about all that and more with our next guest, scientist Robert Kopp. He's an associate professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Rutgers University in New Jersey. He's associate director of the Rutgers Energy Institute, and he was an author in the fifth assessment report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He's a real working scientist. Bob Kopp, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You are co-author of a thought-provoking op-ed in the New York Times, published June 7th. The title is The Deadly Combination of Heat and Humidity. Was that spurred by the massive heat wave that just hit India?
Yes, it was. It was building off of work we had done over the last couple of years, but it was certainly the heat wave in India, which may have caused up to about 2,500 deaths, that spurred us to write that.
How accurate are those death records that are reported by governments and the media?
Well, it really depends. So one of the things it depends upon is what you mean by a death. So the numbers like we're seeing out of India, those are, the number of deaths that are essentially recorded as heat-related deaths. If you're an epidemiologist and then you go and look at heat wave after the fact, what you tend to look at instead are what called excess deaths. So basically, compared to a typical May, how many deaths did you see during this heat wave? And then you also have to account for the fact that there may be some people who died during the heat wave who might ordinarily have just died a couple of weeks later. So there's the statistic of excess deaths, which is usually significantly higher than the direct deaths. So there's that difference. I've also just been looking at the news a little today, and there are some suggestions that the number of direct deaths in this latest heat wave may have been slightly overreported. So maybe more than the sort of 1,600, 2,000 range rather than 2,500 range. But I think those numbers are still going to be sorted out for a while.
Do heat waves only kill people in developing countries?
Not at all. In fact, the most fatal heat waves of the last 115 years and certainly of the last couple of decades have been the ones in Western Europe in 2003 and in Russia in 2010. So not just developing countries.
So one of the factors, it seems to me, leading to more deaths is the number of hot days and hot nights with no relief. Why is that important?
Well, it's if you think about a typical night, if it cools, you have a chance for your body temperature to cool down, you can cope a little more during the day. If it's still just as hot and humid in the middle of the night as it was during the day, and especially if it's just as humid in the middle of the night, and you don't have access to an air-conditioned space, that makes it really hard on you. I mean, think about a really horrible day. You're in Vancouver, so I don't have a great example to give you. But if you've ever been to, say, Washington, D.C. or New Orleans, you can think of like a bad day there. And just think about if you have that, not just day after day, but night after night, as you do in some heat waves, and if you don't have the relief provided by air conditioning or other access to cooled spaces.
The key fact you raise is one we understand physically, but poorly intellectually. We all know heat feels worse when it's humid or muggy, as we might say. What happens to the body to make humid heat more dangerous?
Well, there's basically two ways the body has of cooling itself down. One is basically to expand the blood vessels near the surface of the skin to sort of radiate more heat outward. And that only works if the air outside is cooler than the body, obviously. You can't radiate heat into an environment that's hotter than you. The other main way of releasing heat is of course sweating, right? So you sweat, you get water on the surface of the skin, and then when that water evaporates, it carries off some heat with it. And if you are in a dry environment, that works great, but as it becomes increasingly humid, the ability to cool yourself by sweating becomes weaker and weaker. Meteorologists measure something called wet bulb temperature, which is basically what you measure if you take a thermometer and wrap the bulb of the thermometer in a wet cloth. And that gives you a measurement of the temperature to which you can cool yourself by sweating. So if the wet bulb temperature is 80 degrees Fahrenheit, then nobody's going to be able to cool their skin temperature below 80 degrees Fahrenheit by sweating.
Canadian weather forecasters try to combine that and express that heat and humidity into something called the Humidex Index. Really, there doesn't seem to be a clear way to communicate this to the public yet. Do you have suggestions on how we could do that better?
Well, so the heat index is actually not a bad way of doing this. The wet bulb temperature is more tied to what's going on physiologically. In the American Climate Prospectus, which is the report we did last year for the Risky Business Project, we took wet bulb temperature and divided sort of the extreme wet bulb temperatures up into four categories. So you just think about certain range you might call, say, uncomfortably muggy. So, you know, if you think about Washington, D.C., there might be, say, 5 or 7 weeks in a typical summer that would have wet bulb temperatures that are uncomfortably muggy, say, in the 74 to 80 degree Fahrenheit range. Then wet bulb temperatures get a little higher, say, the 80 to 86 degrees Fahrenheit days. Those are the days where you really have very dangerous conditions. You get heat warnings from the Meteorology Service, National Weather Service in the U.S. Those are the temperatures you see very commonly in bad heat waves, like the 1995 heat wave in the Midwest, like the heat wave in India. And then sometimes they push even higher into what we would call extremely dangerous, or Category 3. And those are ones where, you know, you really start to see a lot of lives at risk. So in India, you started to see wet bulb temperatures pushing up around 86 degrees Fahrenheit on the worst day. The worst wet bulb temperatures in the U.S. occurred during the 1995 heat wave in the Midwest, and in some parts, and particularly in areas that were near recently irrigated fields. So you do have some local effects like that. You were seeing wet bulb temperatures that may have been as high as 90 degrees Fahrenheit. And then once wet bulb temperature gets above 92 degrees Fahrenheit, which basically doesn't happen naturally right now, almost anywhere on the planet, then those are sort of conditions where, you know, if you go on, do some moderate exercise outside for 45 minutes, you basically take your body up to the temperature threshold for heat stroke, which we know because people have done lab experiments.
So from your research and other science, what do we know about how many more such dangerous days Americans will experience in the coming decades due to climate change?
Well, you know, of course, there's always a little bit of uncertainty in these projections, but we can say, well, given what we know now, what do we expect the future to look like? So if you look at the best available climate science and you look at the relationship between temperatures and humidity and how those differ around the country, we could come up with some projections for that. So right now, if you take the average American, just pick a person at random from the population of the lower 48 states, they're probably going to experience about 4 dangerously humid days in a typical summer. By 2030, our projections are that that will increase to about 10 days per summer. And that's more or less locked in no matter what we do with our greenhouse gases, right? The change over the next couple decades is locked in by the carbon dioxide we've already emitted and by the shape of the energy system. You know, we just can't change the energy system that quickly.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. At this point in our conversation, there was interference on the phone line, but Dr. Kopp said, quote, "In the second half of this century, that's where we really feel the effects of changes in greenhouse gases that we start making today. So if we continue on with the fossil fuel-intensive growth trajectory, the average American might be experiencing around 17 dangerously humid days in a typical summer in the 2050s.
You know, getting to the first threshold of sort of where we would be in, say, Louisiana today. So you're going to have you know, as many as much humid heat for the typical American by 2050 as for the typical Louisianan today. And as people have been to Louisiana, you know, it's pretty humid there. On the other hand, if we can bring emissions down somewhat, so basically stabilize emissions where they are now and then really bring them down fairly quickly in the second half of the century, we can sort of push off until about the end of the century where you get to about 18 dangerously humid days a year. And if we were to have really strong reductions, the sort of reductions that are consistent with the international 2°C target and with some of the phrasing in the communique that came out of the G7 yesterday, that could really sort of cap the growth of humidity extremes by the middle of the century.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Rutgers scientist Bob Kopp. You did some of the background analysis that led to the breakthrough report called Risky Business that was launched by luminaries like Hank Paulson and Michael Bloomberg. And it's interesting. I just read some new Australian study that found that indoor office workers who presumably have air conditioning at work in Australia have $1 billion less productivity during heat waves because their sleep is disturbed during hot nights. What did you find out about worker productivity in a hotter world?
Well, our study for the Risky Business Project, wasn't just drawing upon our work. So we drew upon a lot of work that's been done by the economics community over the last decade or so, and then integrated it with state-of-the-art climate projections. And one of the things that's come out of the economics literature over the last decade is that there is a relationship between temperature and productivity. And in this case, productivity, these studies are focusing on the number of hours people actually work. So it's not quality of their work, is just the number of hours work. And there, as you get raised temperatures above around 80 degrees Fahrenheit, there's a decrease in the number of hours that people work. And that's particularly true in some key economic sectors that are especially exposed to heat. So not office workers so much as manufacturing, mining, agriculture, those sorts of sectors where people are either in factories or they're actually directly exposed outdoors to heat. So that has a pretty significant effect on labor productivity. There's a smaller number change in the number of hours worked for people inside, but there is some new work, like the one you mentioned, coming out that's focusing on the quality of the work. And we weren't able to incorporate that into our study, but that's potentially a significant effect. And if you look at these high-risk sectors, sort of, as I said, like manufacturing or outdoor work, you're looking at sort of under that fossil fuel-intensive growth trajectory, maybe a percent or two decrease in labor productivity over the course of the century, which may not seem like much, but just think about that in employment terms, right? I mean, we worry about the difference between a 5% employment and a 6% employment, right? And in the sort of outdoor sectors and manufacturing, that's of that scale.
And I find it interesting, the electric grid is also less productive during heat waves. It takes more power just to cool electric generating plants, and the grid is less efficient. Can you tell us anything about that?
Sure. So there are a couple of things that happen with the electricity grid. So one, there are reduced efficiencies in transmission. There may be strains on production. So, the most obvious example, the one we actually see happening a fair bit, if the cooling water supply, say for a nuclear power plant, gets too warm, you've got to shut down the plant. So that reduces the supply. Another major thing that happens, of course, and it relates to where we started this discussion, is with demand for energy. Of course, on really hot days, lots of people want to turn on the air conditioning, which they need to do to keep themselves healthy. But that drives up demand on the grid. So that drives up the price of electricity. It means that you have to turn on some more power plants, what we call peaker plants, that aren't running a lot of the time. So those also tend to be the worst polluting power plants because they're only run a small fraction of the time. So it contributes to air pollution on bad days. And so all these factors together serve to stress both energy supply and energy demand in heat waves.
So along with a few million people who read Zero Hedge, I happen to think we live in a financial environment that's already fragile and overextended with massive debt. Now, Bob Kopp, what happens to that system if we add, say, 10 more multi-billion dollar storms like Hurricanes Sandy and Katrina?
Well, I think that's a good question. I'm going to speak from my perspective in the U.S., you know, from my perspective in New Jersey, where we were hit by Superstorm Sandy back in 2011, there are a number of things that come into play after these storms, right? So you've got damaged property. People have to rebuild or they may be relocated. And so in the U.S., you've got the National Flood Insurance Program coming in cases like that. And then you've got disaster relief coming in as well. And so, you know, for Superstorm Sandy, that was, I believe, well in the $70 or $80 billion total price range just for that one storm. And if you have more of those, you know, already the National Flood Insurance Program is well out of balance. You know, it was close, its finances were close to in balance until Katrina, and then it was knocked further out of balance by Sandy. And that's actually a fundamental, almost mathematical problem with systems like that. In the cases of these storms, it's really the worst cases that are driving the losses. And you have some cases where basically you can't mathematically have a stable system because the damages are going to be so dominated by the last bad thing that happened to you. And so that makes it hard to run a financially balanced insurance program, which is, of course, why the private sector often cases doesn't insure some of these places that are affected. So one of the major effects is that, you know, more extreme events probably means you have more emergency relief. It means you have more government involved in transferring money to relief, because we're probably not going to, you know, just abandon people who've suffering from floods or droughts or things like that.
In a radio interview on WHYY Radio in Philadelphia, you talked about the many risks that could be assigned a dollar value, easily understood by business. Then you said there are some risks that cannot be expressed economically, but still worry you quite a bit. What were you thinking of there?
Yeah, so I think the thing that worries me the most, and I'm not going to say can't be expressed economically so much as we don't really know how to express it economically, are our dependencies upon ecosystems. You know, humans aren't, you know, we aren't living in a spaceship isolated from our environment. We depend upon ecosystems for clean air and clean water. We know from the geological record that ecosystems can be significantly affected by climate change, but we don't have a good way of projecting a lot of those changes. And so, you know, the thing I worry about, and I worry about it because I don't think we have a good way of assessing it, and maybe it's a significant problem and maybe it's not, is how ecosystems are going to respond to the increasing stress we're placing on them. They started out already stressed by overpopulation and land use changes, and now we're heaping climate change on top of that. And so, you know, that's what I would most worry about.
Now, despite all this, Bob, you're not a total doomer thinking it's all over. How will we cope with this climate mess now that we have changed Earth's primary systems?
Well, I mean, the first thing we do is start taking steps to stop changing them more. You know, as I said, there's already a fair bit that's baked into the system by the choices we've already made, both by the physics of the heat-trapping gases and also by the fact that you can't just turn the global energy system around on a dime. It takes a lot of time. But we can start, as we are starting, shifting the energy system over to an energy system that doesn't rely on carbon that's been buried in the ground for millions of years and not pumping that carbon from the ground into the atmosphere. So one set of actions, what we call mitigation, right? So transitioning away from these fossil fuel dependent energy systems to one that relies on low carbon and zero carbon energy sources like solar and wind. The other major thing is to recognize that we have baked some changes into the system and think about how we're going to adapt to those. So, you know, in the case of, say, sea level rise, that may well mean, as we're starting to see as we rebuild from Sandy in the northeastern U.S., thinking about elevating our houses more, that might buy us some time. We may have to think about retreating from some places along the shore in the longer term. As we mentioned in our article in the Times, we have to think about how we provide cooling for people in heat waves. Air conditioning is one way of doing that, although as we also mentioned, that comes with its own problems because it increases the demand for energy. But we can use more energy efficient building techniques, things like cool roofs that can help reduce that demand for energy. And we similarly need to beef up our public health systems to make sure that we don't let as many people die during heat waves. These adaptation measures are necessary in developed countries like the U.S. and Canada, but they're also especially necessary in places without our strong public health systems and like in the developing world, which are also places where they have a lot more people working in these sort of outdoor work sectors that are particularly sensitive to heat waves.
So you did your PhD thesis on the opposite world, the time when the planet nearly froze over. Just for fun, tell us a little bit about Snowball Earth.
Sure. Part of my thesis was focused on this event that happened around 2.3 billion years ago. So we're jumping timescales from talking about changes in the next 50 years to talking about changes 2.3 billion years ago. But that was a pretty important turning point in the planet's history. Depending on who you ask, either shortly before 2.3 billion years ago or shortly after 2.3 billion years ago, is where you first start seeing clear signs of oxygen being around in significant quantities in the planet. So what we think happened is that sometime around then, that cyanobacteria that are essentially the ancestors of the mechanisms in plant that make oxygen, cyanobacteria evolved the ability to take water and energy from the sun and split it to produce oxygen. And that oxygen was a toxic byproduct. And that oxygen probably interacted with methane in the planet's atmosphere. Nowadays, we think about methane as a greenhouse gas, and that's what it was doing there too. But we think about it in the context of climate change and global warming. And in that context, you know, methane emissions are something we worry about for making the planet too warm. But back 2.5 billion years ago, methane and maybe some other similar gases played a key role in preventing the planet from freezing, because back then the sun was less bright than it was today, emitting about 80% as much, 80% as much heat. And so you needed a thicker greenhouse to keep the planet warm. And then all of a sudden the cyanobacteria evolved. They start pumping oxygen into the atmosphere. Of course, if you combine oxygen and methane and you give it a spark, you've got what you've got in your stove. If you don't give it a spark, the oxygen and methane react more slowly, but they're unstable in the presence of one another. And so if you start pumping oxygen into a methane-rich greenhouse, you can destroy the methane component of that greenhouse. And we think that's what happened and then triggered what we call a snowball Earth, the period of millions of years in which the planet may have been encased in ice from the pole to the equator.
It's amazing. Life is such a big experiment and has been for a couple of billion years. And we sort of zoom back and forth between survival and being right on the edge. We've been speaking with a Rutgers University scientist who is deeply involved in the ways climate will impact the economy, human health, and our lives. Find out more about Dr. Bob Kopp at bobkopp.net, and that's Kopp with two P's. And I recommend his technical notes with more info on the June 7th New York Times op-ed. You can also find more links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
It's been a pleasure to be here.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
I'd like to talk to you a bit further about heat, humidity, and human deaths. Then we can look into a new weather development where storms get stronger, not weaker, as they move over land. It's called the Brown Ocean Effect. Before we do that, let's get in a quick bit of music that is spreading into classrooms and chat rooms around the world. It's a technique of using a kind of hip rap to communicate science. The band calls themselves the Melody Sheep, and you can find their series Symphony of Science on YouTube. This piece is titled Our Biggest Challenge. It's a climate change music video posted on YouTube September 12, 2012, with more than 600,000 views so far.
We are a flexible and innovative species, and we have the capacity to adapt and modify our behavior. Now, we most certainly have to do so if we're to deal with climate change. It's the biggest challenge we have yet faced.
The same thing that keeps the Earth warm, that keeps the Earth warm.
CO2
may make the Earth too warm.
It holds in heat. methane, chlorofluorocarbons, water vapor, and carbon dioxide. They all trap heat. Methane, chlorofluorocarbons, water vapor, and carbon dioxide. They all trap
heat. It is important that the world get together to face the problems which attack us as a unit.
The evidence is clear.
The globe is getting too warm.
We can avoid climate catastrophes. We can do this.
We can change the world.
Science offers us answers to these huge challenges.
It's one global ecosystem.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Every single thing every one of us does,
every one of us does,
affects everybody all over the world. It's one global ecosystem.
Warm, wet, cold or dry, climates all start in the sky. Warm, wet, cold or dry, climates all start in the sky.
When the CO2 is high, the temperature is high, moving together in lockstep. When the CO2 is low, the temperature is low. Moving together.
It is important that the world get together to face the problems which attack us as a unit.
The evidence is clear.
The globe is getting too warm.
We can avoid climate catastrophes.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Science offers us answers
for these huge challenges.
It's one global ecosystem.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Our use of fossil fuels for energy is pushing us towards a climate unlike any seen in the history of civilization.
Adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere warms things up.
The rise in CO2 comes from burning fossil fuels.
When you burn them, bad oxygen makes CO2 that goes in the air.
We're reversing the process by which they form.
We're reversing the process.
We're talking about something that affects the entire Earth. Problems that transcend nations. It is important that the world get together to face the problems which attack us as a unit.
The evidence is clear.
The globe is getting too warm.
We can avoid climate catastrophes.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
Science offers us answers
to these huge challenges.
It's one global ecosystem.
We can do this.
We can change the world.
That was The Melody Sheep. It's called Our Biggest Challenge. Get it on YouTube.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
He's been involved in the climate battle for decades. Jeremy Leggett founded the business Solar Century and the charity Solar Aid. He's chair of Carbon Tracker and author of many books on climate, energy, and society. Until recently, Leggett felt what we all feel, that the fight to decarbonize, to save the planet from terrible climate change, is being lost. Now his website bears the banner, The Winning of the Carbon War. Dr. Jeremy Leggett, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Well, at one time, way back when, as an earth scientist, you did research for big oil companies, is that right?
That's correct. I spent more than a decade on the faculty at the Imperial College of Science and Technology, the Royal School of Mines, and I did quite a bit of research for oil companies, including BP and Shell funded my work on what were then called source rocks, black shales. And now, of course, with shale gas and shale oil there, they're actually reservoir rocks.
Right. They're worth trillions now, so we're told. And then you switched over and wrote some reports for Greenpeace. That is a big change. What drove you to the other side?
My research was on the geological history of the oceans, and I got more and more worried through the 1980s about what the atmospheric scientists were finding about the heat-trapping ability of the greenhouse gases. So that worry never went away. It's just got worse, really, over the years. And ultimately, I quit. I left that world, essentially the world of oil and gas, to campaign on climate change, which is what I see myself as having done ever since, really.
And coming towards the present, tell us about the Triple Threat blog that you've kept for years.
Yeah, so this is, you know, the threat of climate change from the burning of fossil fuels. It's about all that and the events relative to it. It's about energy resources and how, you know, we hear this narrative that there's plentiful energy, but actually I'm in that camp, has to be admitted, a minority camp that think that there may be an awful lot of oil and gas down there under the ground, but how much of it can we actually bring up economically and burn? And we don't think that is anything like as much as the industry is telling folk. And the third threat, of course, is the ever-present scepter of a financial crisis because of the foibles of the capital markets.
And when did you come to feel humanity was losing the battle to prevent very dangerous climate change?
Well, I started out optimistic. I got to the Rio Earth Summit in 1992, and I was cautiously optimistic after that. But then, you know, as the drama unfolded through the 1990s, and the first decade of this century, I began to take a pretty bleak view simply because of the enormous persistence of the incumbency pushback against what I thought were very compelling arguments for big change in society and change that, you know, it was totally within our compass to bring about if we could just summon the collective will. And so I was gloomy until, you know, around May, around the middle of 2013. And then it seemed to me at the time that the tide might be changing. And now, of course, we're living in a time where there are daily developments that I think demonstrate very clearly that the tide is changing. It's changing in a positive direction. There are mega trends emerging. There are remarkable things happening on an almost daily basis now. And that's why I call my book The Winning of the Carbon War, because I think we have begun to win. Now, that's not the same as saying we have won. The book's not called How the Carbon War Was Won. And there's still drama to be lived through on that front. But I think, you know, the tide of war, if you like to use that analogy, has turned.
Do you feel we are at a pivotal moment in the history of this civilization?
I do. And, you know, I don't know that you can call it a moment. It's a time. It's a period of a few years. And I think if we just take the events of the last few days to make my point, the G7 leaders, the industrialized nations, a couple of days ago in Germany, agreed for the first time that their targets were going to be to get rid of fossil fuels, decarbonization 100% by the end of this century. So that's 85 years maximum. And crucially, en route to that, they agreed that the target should be 70%. Now, that's 35 years from now in 2050. So this is going to send a huge signal into the markets. So they're basically saying to the energy incumbency, your days are numbered. And okay, that may seem like a long time, but actually, you know what? 35 years isn't a very long time. In parallel to that, of course, we've got all these remarkable developments in clean energy. So then the next thing I'd, the next day, I woke up and read in the newspapers that there's a poll now that shows that 80% of 18 to 34 year olds think that investing in fossil fuels is a risky thing to do. Can you imagine? I mean, what future does an industry have when you have that higher percentage of young people saying, I don't want my pension to go into any of that stuff? And it's clear what the corollary is. You know, it's all the exciting stuff that's coming out of Silicon Valley and China these days. So I do think we're living in turnaround times, but, you know, it's still ours to mess up. We're, you know, quite capable of doing that, we human beings, are we not?
We are, we are. Tell us what's going on, Jeremy, with the climate and the Vatican and whether that matters.
Yes, I think that's another dimension, you know, because so much of the debate is waged in terms of pure economics, as currently defined, as though putting heat trapping into the gases into the atmosphere has no cost at all. It's not accounted on the books. And, you know, that passes the rational debate. So we're constantly hearing, you know, what's the cost of gas burning versus the cost of solar energy and all the rest of it. And the good news there, of course, is that solar energy is plunging in cost, and most of the incumbency fuels are soaring in cost. That's cost, not price. That's a very important distinction, of course. And yet now the Vatican and other faith groups are taking a really strong interest in all this, because it's about, you know, the fate of creation, after all. And it looks as though the Pope, when his encyclical, you know, his message to all the world's Catholics comes out, it's going to be really strong. I mean, the Vatican's already been making very strong noises about threats to creation and the implications for people's souls if they willfully continue with this kind of destructive behavior. So I think that adds a whole new dimension to the drama. I think there ought to be an ethical side to all this. If everything is just about the bottom line, you know, what the economics are, however defined, at the end of the day, it's a pretty sorry state of affairs.
Yes, well, certainly there are people who are outside our economic system as we understand it. We have Bangladeshis on low-lying plains that are contributing nothing practically to the carbon problem, and they're going to lose their homes. And then we have all the species, Jeremy, that are absolutely innocent that are going to be wiped out or made extinct by climate change.
That's right. And their existence and right to existence, what's the price put on that? Well, you know, usually precisely nothing. So yeah, it kind of adds to the point about the ethical situation.
So to be honest, though, Jeremy, I have very low expectations for any concrete action coming out of the Paris climate talks next December. But what do you think?
I think they're going to make progress. I mean, I don't think they're going to solve the problem with a treaty that they all sign and wave around. It's much bigger than that. This is a long game, right? Let's say that the objective is to decarbonize sometime this century, as close as we can to 2050, the other side of it. And that, the scientists tell us, would give us a good chance of staying below, you know, this notional danger ceiling of 2 degrees Celsius. I do think that Paris can come up with a suite of agreements that keeps us on course for that. All right. So that would be a positive outcome. It would be the right direction of travel. Whereas Copenhagen, the previous major climate summit, was a catastrophe. I mean, it sent no signal at all. Well, if anything, it sent a signal saying, burn away, people. You ain't going to be controlled at all. So Copenhagen was a disaster. If we have another one of those, it will be very grim. But I don't think that's what's coming. And I think the Americans and the Chinese and their bilateral discussions have created a very positive agenda in the talks. I think there are all sorts of other actors who are getting it about the dilemma that we face with climate change and acting strongly. I mean, Mrs. Merkel, the German Chancellor, this G7 decision to set as a target the end of fossil fuels before the end of the century, you know, that was her pushing very hard. She didn't have to, as host, push that through, but she did. She even got the Canadians and the Japanese to sign up to it, and they're real laggards on climate change. So, you know, there's lots of positive indicators going into Paris, and this is all against the backdrop of stuff that's happening, even if you don't think climate change is a problem. If you think it's all, you know, some conspiracy or whatever crazy theory, you know, some people have about the whole thing, then just look at what's happening with the contrasting camps. The incumbency costs are going up and up. They're wasting more and more money on frontiers, particularly coal, but also oil and gas, producing diminishing returns on investment, whereas the clean energy technologies are now, of course, every year the majority of those that are deployed in electricity, and their costs on the whole are coming down steeply, solar and storage in particular.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest from the UK, solar entrepreneur, activist, and climate author, Dr. Jeremy Leggett. Let's talk more about your project to chronicle the carbon war. First of all, what makes it a war?
Yeah, I get a bit of stick for that, especially from my female friends, and they say, you know, heaven's sake, it's not a war. People aren't being shot. You had too many toy soldiers when you were a boy, and that's probably true. But, you know, it feels like a civil war to me. You know, the several reasons for that. First of all, the incumbency lobbyists often talk about war themselves. I mean, this is their language. They tell executives in the coal, oil, and gas companies, you are, to quote one of them recently, in endless war against, you know, insurgents and all the rest of it. They use that language, and that's how their cutting-edge action feels to me. It feels like a civil war because, like civil wars, this is essentially a struggle between two belief systems, end member belief systems. And as in any civil war, you get people who believe in different belief systems under the same roof. So, you know, within the same government, within the same political party, even conservative parties, you can find people who think global warming is a hideous conspiracy or nothing to worry about, and you can find people who think it's a huge problem and actually want to go the direction of the green industrial revolution. Do you see what I mean? And it's the same within the big energy companies themselves, many of them. I know I have many friends in these companies, and they tell me that behind closed doors there are ferocious, you know, arguments about how to face up to the problem and all the rest of it. Maybe not in ExxonMobil, okay, but certainly in some of the other companies.
So in a sense, Jeremy Leggett, you're writing a kind of open source book to help us keep track of climate developments. How is it going to work?
Well, I've been publishing it on the first of every month or thereabouts for, since March, and I'll keep going every month right through to the last scene, which will be the last night of the Paris Climate Summit in December. And so the final chapter will be published, or edition will be published on the 1st of January. And that will then serve as a chronicle for what I hope will be, you know, viewed through the prism of, or the rear view mirror, as it were, as the chronicling of the winning of the carbon war.
So before we get back to that, I'd like to ask you to put on your hat as a solar entrepreneur in Britain. How is it going?
It's going pretty well. We're not the most attractive solar market in the world because of basically this civil war I've talked about. We've had endless struggles inside government, inside the Conservative Party that controls the government. You know, with gas lobbyists on one side who want to put renewables in a box and frack Britain to prosperity with shale gas, none of which, of course, has been produced yet or remotely close to being produced, and others who say, no, this is wrong. We should go for Silicon Valley and China, what they're doing. We should craft a green industrial revolution. So they've been struggling with each other within the government, and the net effect of that has been a kind of stop-start, you know, okay-ish solar market. It's not as good as the solar market that you have in California or the one that the Chinese now have, but, you know, it's okay. So Solar Century, the company I founded, operates in Britain but also Africa and Latin America, and we're a kind of healthy, touch wood, middleweight company. We're not a rock star like SolarCity or Sun Edison, to name two American companies, but we're turnover £200 million this year, so, and we're pretty well cashed up and pretty profitable, so, you know, we're a healthy middleweight company, and that to me is a successful nonviolent direct action, because, you know, that having created something like that, I see that as an intervention in the market and a piece of climate campaigning to show what can be done. My investors hate it when I talk like that, of course, but that's how I see it.
And briefly, what is Solar Aid?
We, Solar Century, set up a charity with 5% of our profits. And Solar Aid is it. It's a solar lighting charity. We sell solar lights in Africa, subsidized. And we've created a retail arm called Sunny Money, which is the number one retailer of solar lighting in the whole of Africa. We've sold 1.7 million solar lights in Africa. And, you know, that's wonderful work, because every one of those lights over its lifetime, apart from saving a ton of carbon dioxide, saves an African household an average of $70 a year. We know this from our follow-up research. There's a lot you can do with that when you're that poor.
Sunny Money. I love it, and I think that's a real accomplishment. That's great. Now, getting back to this chronicle of a carbon war, as a climate journalist myself, I can't possibly keep up with the major developments that come out every week, and scientists tell me the same about new research. It's announced so quickly all over the world. Do you think, Jeremy, we need some kind of central climate information service, or do we need more independent voices like yourself? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, both, really. I mean, you know, there's a lot that can be done with government resources, and I think, to be fair, you know, some people are trying very hard. There is a real issue of information overload. I myself struggle very badly to keep up. You know, so far I've managed to keep up, but, you know, I'm putting in 4-5 hours a day on top of all the other things I'm doing, just covering everything that's relevant to energy and climate, because so much is happening. And that one of the reasons why I'm writing the book is to help people who are really busy, who don't have those hours, you know, to have a quick catch-up service that is hopefully an enjoyable read as well, because I tell it like an epic story, which of course is what it is. But, you know, most people are not, and I find so many people as I go around my business who just are missing the most basic things that are going on. And it's not surprising. You can't blame people. Even my own company, they rock up to work at, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning. They've got a computer in their face all day, you know, designing solar farms or whatever it is they do in the company. They're not even reading the newspapers, let alone the technical websites and all the rest of it.
Well, we've been down so long, more or less at the mercy of powerful fossil fuel corporations and the media and governments that support them. It's hard to imagine winning. Could you tell us, what would it look like? What could society look like on the other side in a renewable world?
I think that people are going to be amazed at how fast it goes now. That's my honest belief. I don't know how much of this is wishful thinking, but, you know, I think it's going to be as fast as some of the other real disruptions. Let's take the internal combustion engine. You know, the famous pictures of Fifth Avenue in 1900, the view down Fifth Avenue is packed with horse-drawn carriages, beautiful horse-drawn carriages. And 13 years later, what do you see in the same view? Not a horse-drawn carriage in sight. They're all horse-less carriages. And I think that's what's coming with solar, with storage, with the use of electricity for transportation. I think it's going to take people's breath away, because we're not good collectively at spotting these disruptions in society coming. And this one can be a good one because of all the innate characteristics of renewable energy that give you, you know, security, national security, personal security. And that's my belief. Now, of course, all of that can be disrupted itself by accidents of the human condition. If we end up falling out with the Chinese or the Russians or something, and there's some horrific war, then all bets are off. We're really going to be hoisted by our own stupidity, and all that could happen. But I do think there's a very good chance of a renaissance. That's what I call it in the book, a renaissance that will be built around the new clean ways of using independent energy.
We've been talking with one of the powerhouses of climate activism, entrepreneurship, and green information. Dr. Jeremy Leggett is writing an account of the battle to save civilization from wrenching climate change. It's called A Chronicle of the Carbon War, and you can read the installments of it free at jeremyleggett.net. Leggett has two G's and two T's in it. You can find more links about this discussion in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Jeremy, I know you are crazy busy these days. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thanks for letting me do that.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Let's get back to what we need to know to prevent heat deaths, or at least some of them. The essential concept is supposedly easy, but I admit, I have a hard time wrapping my mind around it. Perhaps it's because the wet bulb measurement adds a new dimension when we think about temperature. Temperature is easy when you think in Fahrenheit or Celsius. Big numbers are hotter. But when we add the dimension of humidity, a bigger number is not necessarily more deadly. For example, it could be 100 degrees Fahrenheit or 38 degrees C, but if it's dry, humans can still sweat and cool themselves. But if we take a common thermometer, say mercury, in a glass tube, and wrap the wet material around a bulb at the bottom, the essential result is, at what temperature does that wetness evaporate, or conversely, take in even more water from the surrounding atmosphere? That temperature-humidity ratio is called the wet bulb temperature, but confusingly, it's also called the dew point. What is a dew point? Wikipedia defines it this way, quote, "The dew point is the temperature at which water vapor in a sample of air at constant barometric pressure condenses into liquid water at the same rate at which it evaporates. At temperatures below the dew point, water will leave the air. The condensed water is called dew when it forms on a solid surface," and dew is D-E-W. Our interview with Dr. Kopp makes it clearer with some examples. A dew point of 86 degrees or above, he says, is dangerous for human health, especially for more vulnerable people like the elderly, babies, and people with certain medical conditions. It's not safe to work outside at that wet bulb temperature, doing strenuous tasks, if the dew point is 86 degrees or more. So how high can it go? Again, Wiki says this, quote, "A dew point of 91 degrees Fahrenheit, 33 degrees C, was observed at 2 p.m. on July 12, 1987, in Melbourne, Florida. A dew point of 90 degrees Fahrenheit, 32 degrees C, has been observed in the United States on at least two occasions, Appleton, Wisconsin, at 5 p.m. on July 13, 1995, and New Orleans Naval Air Station at 5 p.m. on July 30, 1987. A dew point of 95 degrees Fahrenheit, 35 degrees C, was observed at Dharan, Saudi Arabia, at 3 p.m. on July 8, 2003. Dew points this high are extremely rare occurrences," end quote from Wikipedia. The very high dew point reading in Wisconsin in 1995 coincides with the infamous Chicago heat wave that killed at least 750 people. I recall the city of Chicago morgue was overwhelmed and had to bring in refrigeration trucks to stack the bodies. We already know from climate science that the world is getting hotter and the atmosphere is getting wetter. Warmer air holds more water vapor. In general, the world's atmosphere contains about 7% more water now than it did in 1970. That's a huge amount. Almost oceans of water running through the air. In some cases, it forms atmospheric rivers. If those coincide with a heat wave, deaths of unprotected, uncooled humans will result. We all need to learn this, and learn the numbers, whether it's called wet bulb temperature, humidex, or dew point. Weather forecasters, city authorities, and citizens will need to really grasp this increasing threat with climate change. More and more, we are finding that climate change develops into new phenomenon not seen before. It's stretching our human imagination. There are seldom good things coming from it. That's why some prefer the term climate disruption for this phase of transition into a different climate. The novelty of these discoveries means we all need to become students again, no matter how old we are or what our profession might be. Here's another one, courtesy of NASA, the U.S. National Aeronautics and Space Administration. It's called the Brown Ocean Effect. I owe our Radio EcoShock guest Robert Marston Fanny a tip of the hat for bringing this to all of our attention in his entry in Robert Scribler's blog. Here's my understanding of this new thing. In our experience of storms in the last century, in the 1900s, any hurricane, typhoon, or cyclone tended to pick up extra energy from a warm ocean and then lose strength as it passed over land. There was less water over land to add energy through evaporation. All weather forecasts took this sort of law of storms for granted. Now, in a climate-changed world, that may not happen. NASA tells us that if certain conditions are met, storms may now keep their strength over land or even get stronger. You can imagine the damage that could result. Here's what NASA said in a study in 2013. Quote, a brown ocean environment consists of three observable conditions. First, the lower level of the atmosphere mimics a tropical atmosphere with minimal variation in temperature. Second, soils in the vicinity of the storms need to contain ample moisture. Finally, evaporation of the soil moisture releases latent heat, which the team found must measure at least 70 watts averaged per square meter. For comparison, the latent heat flux from the ocean averages about 200 watts per square meter. End of quote from NASA. So the wet land acts like a water energy source, like a brown ocean. Now let's go to a concrete example. There was a lot of concern that the most recent tropical storm to hit Texas, named Bill, might meet these conditions. After all, Texas and Oklahoma had just been slammed with record rains and flooding. There was lots of water left on and in the ground. Would Bill pick up strength as it headed inland? In this case, it appears it did not happen. Bill sort of dissipated. NASA has documented such brown ocean cases with the best-known storm happening in Texas and the central states in 2007. In fact, they say there have been 16 cases where tropical cyclones kept their power or increased it while traveling over land in the United States. NASA also expects more brown ocean events as climate change develops. That turns storm forecasting on its head. What used to weaken over land can maintain its destructive power or even get worse. It's another development in our understanding of extreme weather events in an era of human-induced climate change. You'll hear more about violent storms that won't quit, even if the weather person on TV doesn't tell you why. I don't know if this will be the hottest June the human world has ever recorded. It sure feels like it here, where the temperature soars over 100 degrees or 38 degrees Celsius day after day in what should be the Canadian spring. The fact that the El Niño hot water system in the Pacific has not declined probably adds our journey to another record hot year in 2015. It's amazing. The rainy city of Vancouver, Canada just had its driest month of May ever. June is hot and dry. It's like San Diego moved way north. Meanwhile, I thank you for listening. I hope we are enriching our group mind with essential knowledge.